Number 15A.
We come to cassette 15. Well, this brings us to the new subject, love as a main tone. We have seen that this is the tone where we see that through faith, man partakes of universal salvation. This was very new in that age, that not only the Jews should be saved, but that there should be a universal salvation. Not only that, but also to show that nobody can escape salvation. Why did he point that out? He pointed that out because he reproached the Jews that they have not really lived up to their promise, and that therefore the promise will go to the Gentiles, and the Gentiles will find really the salvation before the Jews, and that will then afterwards evoke the Jews to imitate the Gentiles and get their salvation too. So he was actually declaring that all nations, Jews and Gentiles, will have salvation, and therefore there is no escape from it. The tone of love that is here relevant is that God has a universal plan, and that even that humanly we may not be able to conceive of that plan, to see the purpose of the plan, that we may not see the single steps leading really to the final goal, that we are unaware of that, that we cannot fathom this plan, but that there is such a plan. And that therefore we should have faith in love, faith in God, and through that faith we have the promise of love for that universal salvation. He could see that there were not many signs in the world that such a thing could happen. But he said, you know, somewhere hidden away is always a remnant that is not seen, that is insignificant, but there will always be a remnant, and the remnant will be the promise. Through them, the universal salvation will come about. Therefore, he speaks of an unsearchable plan that is at work and shows that very hard thing for the Jews, that those nations which were not God's nation would be the first one to be his nation or his people. He's quoting quite a few passages from the Old Testament, especially from the prophets, which all said that those who were not God's beloved became God's beloved, that that God will call them my people who were not my people. This is from the prophets, naturally indicating that those who are not my people were the Gentiles, those that were outside the Judean reach of God. And so Paul comes and says, no, it will just be the other way around. This is the general tone in love, and so we can discuss together how Paul slowly builds up that whole unsearchable plan of salvation, and therefore we can ask ourselves, how does love really work out its plan of universal salvation? I think that is the overall question for this part. So he starts out with love as mind. And what do we find here? What is here the first initial movement that we can see? Yes, as the children of the flesh. And what did he mean by the children of the flesh? Did he mean a special... Yes. Well, I wonder, isn't it that what that he meant, that the children of the flesh, meaning that those that were the descendants of Abraham, that they were not those who were the children of promise, huh? that children of promise are not according to the flesh, therefore descendants in the family tree, I think you call it, the descendants of Abraham, but the children of promise were what? Those who, that only those that counted for the seed. How does he put that? It's a very nice way. Yeah, that the children of the promise are counted for the seed. You see, he had to deal with the Jewish concept that if you were a descendant of Abraham, you were anyway belonging to the promise of Abraham. And he had to say, no, only those who after the spirit of Abraham, namely faith, the faith that Abraham showed, would be the seed of promise. So that he would say that not the flesh, the fleshly descendant were the promise, but the spiritual descendant were the promise, so that everyone who would have the same faith as Abraham had, that he would partake of the promise. So at this point one can see that Paul was trying to lift out the promise out of a fleshly creation into the spiritual creation. Only the men of God's calling, really, he considered to be the seed of promise. Yeah, do you remember how he was showing that in the Israelitish history, how he could prove it, so to say, what he was saying? What historical fact did he take there? Yes, Rebecca, huh? Shall have a son. And didn't she also have another son?
Yes.
Yeah, we are not so well trained in the biblical history, are we? Yes. So that really both bear from the flesh, so to say, but only one had the promise. Huh? And therefore he tried to show that not just all that are descendants of the flesh have the promise, but only to them to which the promise has been given, meaning naturally that the promise is to them who believe. We shall live by faith was his great subject. Yeah. All right, so he starts out with that universal plan of salvation at the point of mind and says, well, those who believe, to them is given the promise of salvation. Not just to them that are born after the flesh. So we can see our whole salvation lies in this, that we start out with the seed. So the seed is always the idea. The whole biblical symbolism, a seed was a symbol, huh? For idea, because out of that seed always would grow everything. It was the first initial impact that comes to age one. And so we begin to see that salvation belongs to the idea. That the true idea has the promise. We know that so well because we know the 7 days of creation, and in the 7 days of creation we see that the first day has within itself already everything that is necessary to bring about the fulfillment of the seventh day. Because one day grows out from the preceding day, so this seed is a symbol of idea. Therefore we can summarize this as saying, well, love alone knows the promise of the idea. So here, again, as we were discussing it before, when we come to the tone of mind, it's usually, in Paul, the tone of idea, that man is idea. But only the idea man has a promise, that man after the flesh has no real promise in himself. So we start out with man as idea and know that God knows man only as idea. Then we go further to spirit. What do we find here? Yes, I think that's one of the points here, that God uses everything for the fulfillment of his purpose. In other words, everything serves a good purpose. There's not something that is excluded that does not serve the divine purpose of fulfillment. And he takes as an example Pharaoh. Well, Pharaoh naturally was, for the Jewish people, just anathema, was a symbol of the greatest enemy, of the greatest, horror. And now Paul interprets it and says, well, God can use everyone for a good purpose, and shows that even Pharaoh was used, namely to show, why does he think that Pharaoh was even a symbol to show something good? That's typical for his reasoning in general then. Do you remember what he said about Pharaoh? Well, he said, only if you have really a so-called big enemy, you can prove how big God is by giving a victory over Pharaoh. If the enemy is small, then you don't win a big victory. If the enemy is very big and very fearful and very tenacious and you win the victory, then you really prove the glory of God. How can we prove the glory of God except through a victory? So he feels that everything in the universe has a purpose, and a purpose not for evil, but for good. Yes? So we know that in our own life, don't we? We know in our own life that there comes along a situation which we deem to be wrathful and afflictive, and love can make it an angel entertained unawares. That's the big subject in the chapter on Apocalypse, at the tone of love, also like here, that she shows there on, Mrs. Eddy shows there, that actually spirit is the only, that you don't have dualism in your universe, that love knows no dualism, that love only knows the oneness of being, and therefore everything that happens in that universe can serve the divine purpose. This is a terrific insight. It frees us from a sense of a dualistic universe that we always seem that we have to classify everything either as good or evil. And the moment we classify something as good and evil, we have a constant fight. We try to fight evil with good, and therefore we are in a constant fight. It's that point where Mrs. Eddy says that she finally gave up the warfare and so the oneness of spirit. Here too, love has no enemies, we also say. That love knows no accuser, has no enemy, has no duality. And that is what he brought in. The Jewish law naturally had always that dualistic sense. If you obey the law, you are well off. If you don't obey the law, you go to hell. So that dualistic law, that carnal law, is being broken here. And Paul shows, no, it's only in your consciousness. You just have to see things in a proper perspective. And then you don't have any more dualism. Then you feel that everything serves a good purpose. Actually, this is an attitude which is quite terrific, at which I feel we haven't always gained, that we still are day in and day out somehow mesmerized that there are two powers at work in the universe, and that there is constantly a danger for us, and that something can happen any time that would threat us, whereas in love that only knows loveliness, love that only knows its own objectification, in love where there is the oneness of principle and idea being expressed, in that attitude, even Pharaoh is a tool of God. So in that attitude, even a sickness, an accident, can be the tool of good. It's a matter what we make out of it. By itself, nothing is good or evil. It is thinking that makes it so. It's the great motto, it's the great epigraph at the beginning of the textbook, and therefore covers, so to say, the whole textbook and shows the most fundamental error we have to meet is actually the sense of dualism. Yes, I think this is what he shows here. He also brings out that God is not partial, but that he is absolutely impartial naturally. If we see that everything serves a good purpose, then you cannot have partiality. The moment we have partiality, the one is good and the one is evil. The one is better and the one is less good. Shall we go to the next subject, to soul? Love as soul. Yes. Here comes out what? Here is the remnant, huh? A lost seed. That which has not lost its identity. And what does it say about that remnant? Sorry? The remnant shall be saved, yeah? And the promise belongs to that remnant. Yes? Yeah? What else comes out here with that, in the tone of soul? Very beautiful tone, which I have mentioned right at the beginning of this hour. What he brings out. Yes, yes. Huh? He shows that there, in order to show that there is no duality now in soul, he identifies everyone divinely. But even those which was not called his people will be called his people. I don't know if he has other, yes. Naturally, this is also a translation, it's a reformation, it's an, yes. Every true identification demands translating out of a wrong sense into the true sense. And so here he quotes Hosea and says, I will call them my people, which were not my people, and her beloved, which was not beloved. He could go on and on, showing that soul always translates evil back into good, so that there is only one true identity. Yes? And then he speaks about that remnant that is always left there. It's a most beautiful sense, that point of remnant. We have always seen in the world that things outwardly can seem very dark, very hopeless, and somewhere hidden away in secrecy, there is somehow a stable where the little Bethlehem child lies, unnoticed, but perhaps just worshipped by a few wise men, and when it grows, when that idea grows, it becomes the Savior. So in the world of every age, there was always somehow what one calls a man standing in the gap. There was always a true idea standing in the gap. And so we can see there is always a remnant standing in the gap that will save the world. Or a plan of love would not have an identity. So that's a very big point here. All right, what have we seen up to now? It's always good when one recapitulates quickly so that one doesn't lose the thread of thinking. We have seen first that the plane of love knows its own idea, the seed of promise. That idea is never fleshly, material, but it's always spiritual. It's a spiritual seed. Then, in spirit, we have seen that the spiritual seed is always good, and that what God sows is always good. Even if it looks evil, like a Pharaoh, it's still good. There is no duality in it. So that love knows no duality, only knows the oneness, only knows its own idea. Love never losing sight of its own idea. And that is good. So that the whole universe can serve the idea. Then we come to soul and says, it is so, that soul takes that which was considered to be not my people and makes it my people. Soul says, because I have only one universe, I make those who seem to be not my beloved to be my beloved. It exchanges the false sense for the true idea, so that only one idea stands out, and that is God's own idea of salvation. That's mind, spirit, soul. Can you translate that to your own life situation? We too, individually, collectively, universally, seem to be in a situation where we feel that there is no God, no plan of God at work, where we feel everything is going upside down, everything is stumbling over, and with every day it seems to be more hopeless and more hopeless. Where is there a way out? What will be the Savior? Where is the Savior? Individually, collectively, and universally. So we can go back to the Christ idea and say, now, look here. How would it be if we would look out from God instead to look out from the situation? Looking out from God, we would see that love has never lost sight of loveliness, that love always has an idea and always plants its own true idea, and that to this idea belongs the promise. Through that idea, the salvation will take place. Is that idea really the only thing? Aren't there big, powerful opposers and accusers in the world? Aren't there many pharaohs in the world? And so love as spirit comes and says, perhaps to you it looks that way, it doesn't look that way to me. To me, everything is there to serve a good purpose. And therefore, there is only one thing going on, that's love as spirit, only the good. Yes, that's nice, but then we say, but what will happen to all those who are against it, who are the opponents? And love as soul will say, those who are my opponents will be my own. The people that were against me will be my people. That which did not love the idea will be the beloved. I, soul, can change anything. So love as soul is that universal transforming power that can transform. Usually those who have been most strong against our teaching have become very often the best supporters the moment they have seen it. So we don't really need to fall just on the first sight. We have to wait and see that the idea works in everyone, that the idea works for the good, and therefore can reform and exchange unexpectedly. That's love's plan. Love as mind, love as spirit, love as soul. Don't you like Romans? Huh? Yes? Isn't that the story of us? It isn't Paul's story. It's the Christ story. The Christ is ever present. So, can you see what you should do? You should really take this assignment serious. They are really something. And it would, instead that we are afraid all through the year what will happen politically, military-wise, and I don't know, internationally-wise, financially-wise, economically-wise, instead of spending all that time on that, spend it on something that is good. And just culture your consciousness a little bit in love and mind, love and spirit, love and soul. It's not lost time, not at all. It's the best time, the best way to use our time.